Hello, your Hollywood reporter, Rocket Ron Schumacher. I host middays on 103.5 WGRR, Cincinnati's greatest hits, including playing your favorites from noon to 1 weekdays on Lunchtime Greats by request. Great to be back on radio reading services with the latest from Tinseltown and Entertainment Weekly magazine. The October issue is a double issue with Jennifer Aniston and Reese Witherspoon on the cover and the title Power Couple, Jen and Reese Make News Inside Apple's The Morning Show. And of course, a regular feature in Entertainment Weekly magazine is the must list. And at number one on the must list for October, a movie, Judy. Long before she stepped into the ruby slippers of the Hollywood icon, Renee Zellweger had a special connection to Judy Garland. My parents were sort of selective about who was celebrated in our house, and she was always there, says the Texas native, age 50, as she recalls her childhood. We watched her films, and there she was on the turntable, and I was always aware when they were doing a rerun of one of her shows. We'd gather round and watch. I didn't know about any of the challenges that she was grappling with later in her life. Those dark days are depicted in Judy, which is out in theaters, directed by theater veteran Rupert Gould. In a staggering performance certain to catapult her into the Oscar race, Zellweger plays the Wizard of Oz star at her lowest point and sings many of her most cherished songs, including Over the Rainbow. Broke and unemployable because of her addictions, the star was forced to leave her children in Los Angeles in the winter of 1968 and perform shows at London's Talk of the Town nightclub. Among Garland's devotees, the singer's wildly erratic gigs there, sometimes brilliant, often disastrous, are legendary. The following year, on June 22nd, Garland died of an overdose. I found it fascinating that a woman who began working at 2 could find herself living under such stressful circumstances after so many years of work, says Zellweger. And then to see her lampooned in a lot of the retelling of her story, you know, from my little experience with it, I know there's more to it, that there are omissions. Zellweger couldn't be more different from Garland, but she's already proved herself to be a chameleon. After breaking out as Tom Cruise's love interest in Jerry Maguire in 1996, Zellweger nabbed her first Oscar nomination by playing the titular English singleton in 2001's Bridget Jones' Diary. And a year later, she earned her second Oscar nod by wowing critics as singing, dancing murderess Roxy Hart in Chicago. In 2003, her role as strong-willed Ruby in Cold Mountain won her an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress. Still, learning to speak in Garland's distinctive voice and having to sing her immortal songs live on camera was an entirely different challenge. I never tried to hit any of those notes before. I mean, maybe in the shower it was a good idea, Zellweger says with a laugh. So I started the vocal training and the practical training that I could, just to see what that felt like, and then to see what was necessary in order to actually make that sound. Zellweger also had to match the pitch and raspiness of Garland's cadence, which by 1968 had been altered by years of alcohol and drug abuse. If Judy finds its heroine at rock bottom, Zellweger says portraying her never made her despair. If the darkness was all that remained, then it might have been a different experience. Her joy and her wit and her kindness and her humor never left. She was wildly funny. Garland's surviving family members, including daughter Liza Minnelli, weren't involved in the making of the film, but Zellweger did have hours of historical Garland footage on the internet to help inform the performance. I went down the rabbit hole, and I stayed there, Zellweger says. She was always there, in headphones at night. There was always something to go to sleep with. I wanted to feel her essence around and then tell a human story, not mimicry. As for the awards buzz, Zellweger is trying her best to tune it out. I'm just not aware of this stuff, she says. I've got to figure out puppy care for her pooches Chester and Ellie, and get them healthy before I go, to the Toronto International Film Festival, that is, where Judy is one of the most anticipated releases. Never mind that for now. There's just pills and creams and baths and all kinds of things going on over here, says the low-key star. And you thought Toto was a handful. This article written by Tim Stack. I'm a huge Star Wars fan, so excited to bring you the first take part of Entertainment Weekly magazine for October, an exclusive preview of your next obsessions. It's on Carrie Fisher, A Life on the Edge. Sheila Weller's new biography charts the wild highs and wrenching lows of a Hollywood original, a child of show business who found her own voice. The actress and author was hilarious, sad, and unforgettable. Speaking to some of those who knew Carrie Fisher best, Arthur Sheila Weller crafted Carrie Fisher, A Life on the Edge, which will be out November 12th. an anecdote-filled journey chronicling the actress and writer's incredible life, including a fly-on-the-wall view of her wild celeb-filled house parties. With money now from Star Wars, Carrie wanted an outpost in her hometown, so she bought a house next door to her friend Terry Garr's log cabin in Laurel Canyon. It was a tiny house, and Carrie decorated felicitously. She put a big statue of a foot on the front lawn and had cutouts of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs on the stairs. When she and Paul Simon were in Los Angeles, she gave parties there, where a gourmet cook was on the premises teaching everyone cuisine. The hired chef was supposed to give us lessons, Terry Garr recalled, and we'd all watch him cook and try to learn how, but mostly we'd just drink a lot of wine. Eventually, she rented out that Laurel Canyon house and bought a house on Oak Pass in Benedict Canyon. There, for her editor guests, especially the female ones, life at Carrie's was like a sorority house on Friday night, and it often included the new custom in Carrie's life, which would make her a social icon for 30 years, her legendary joint October birthday parties with Penny Marshall. A more exclusive, A-list-filled, in-demand party in Hollywood or anywhere didn't exist than the Carrie Penny parties. Nina Jacobson, now one of Hollywood's major producers, once said to a journalist that when she and her girlfriend Jen first started attending them, "We felt bad for not being famous," because the guests were, by Nina's estimation, 85% incredibly famous people. "We were wondering what we were doing there." The guest list was such that celebrities got quietly excited over fellow celebrities. At one party early on, a friend says, "When I saw Barbra Streisand walk in, I had to walk out and hyperventilate." In fact, it is said that Barbra wanted to hire Carrie's housekeepers, Gloria and Mary, to serve the same Southern fare at her parties, but Carrie wouldn't let Barbra do so. Although these evening parties were for pleasure rather than networking, networking inevitably occurred. Albert Brooks says, "Because I met Meryl Streep at a party at Carrie's house, and I had just written Defending Your Life, I said to her, 'You wouldn't be interested in playing the lead in my movie, would you?' She was, and did." Elizabeth Taylor and Carrie had long made peace, as had Debbie Reynolds and Elizabeth. Elizabeth was often an attendee. Says Bruce Valanche, "I remember at one party where there was Jeff Goldblum and Gina Davis and maybe Timothy Leary, and Carrie said, 'Excuse me, I have to go and feed Elizabeth.' Carrie would give her special treatment. She would trot over to fix Elizabeth a plate and clear a special area where she would dine. Carrie talked about it as if it were her duty." Another guest remembers this. During one party, Elizabeth was talking with her hands, and she noticed everyone staring at her huge ring from Richard Burton, the one that went almost straight to her knuckle. So, in a showy gesture to all the gawkers, she popped her finger in her mouth and theatrically took the ring off with her teeth. Another time, Carrie telephoned a friend in advance of the party and said, "You have to come. Elizabeth is coming in her wheelchair, and Eddie Fisher is coming in his wheelchair, and Debbie... no wheelchair. Sweet justice. We'll be at the door greeting them." When the guest arrived, the friend recalls, "That is exactly what happened. Debbie Reynolds, the queen of the world, still standing." Up next, Paul Reiser and Helen Hunt in Mad About You. They may have called the series finale The Final Frontier in a nod to the show's theme song, but it turns out that 20 years later, Paul Reiser and Helen Hunt are still mad about each other. So Spectrum Originals is serving up a limited series revival of the award-winning sitcom Mad About You. The first 6 episodes in the continuing adventures of Paul and Jamie Buckman will drop November 20th, with another 6 episodes appearing December 18th. In Entertainment Weekly's exclusive first look, we see a black-and-white snap of the still-married New Yorkers that echoes the original opening sequence showing the couple out and about in New York City. That image, among several others, will be used in the opening credits, says showrunner Peter Tolan, who's worked on Rescue Me and The Job. Some of those pictures were taken in some of the same locations as the original, and some are totally new. Tolan knows what diehard fans are thinking, though. What about that series finale that flashed far into the future? Believe me, there was a lot of discussion about that final episode and how we were going to conveniently ignore it, he says. There's things we wanted the latitude to explore without committing to that version of the narrative. So I think there will be some true fans who will go, "What the heck just happened?" But for everyone else, I think they'll be perfectly fine with how it lays out. This article written by Sarah Rodman. Up next, no host with the most. Entertainment Weekly critic Kristen Baldwin weighs the pros and cons of the Emmys going MC-free. A moment of silence, please. for the hopes and dreams of anyone who still aspires to host the Emmys or the Oscars. With that announcement in August that Fox's Emmy broadcast, which happened last month, will be hostless, a decision that follows the enjoyably host-free Oscars in February, it seems the time for Patuxent comedians shepherding these award ceremonies has come to an end. Of course, Fox's choice to proceed sans host was likely made in part out of necessity. The network has no late-night talent to draw from, and the performers who have hosted the Emmys on Fox in the past, Brooklyn Nine-Nine's Andy Samberg and Glee's Jane Lynch, have since signed with new employers. Yes, Family Guy creator Seth MacFarlane still works for Fox, but after his regrettable We Saw Your Boobs Oscar-hosting gig of 2013, he doesn't seem like a viable option. And you know what? I think it's all going to be okay. Looking back at past Emmy and Oscar and Golden Globe broadcasts, it's clear that the highlights of these award shows occurs more often than not during the interstitial moments. The 2011 Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy nominees lining up on stage, beauty pageant style, and cheering giddily as Melissa McCarthy was literally crowned the winner, complete with a sash and bouquet of roses. Bryan Cranston grabbing Julia Louis-Dreyfus and planning a steamy kiss on her in 2014. Director Glenn Weiss proposing to his girlfriend on camera in 2018. And of course, the speeches. Hall of Fame shout out to Merritt Wever's I Gotta Go in 2013. If we're losing anything in this sea change, it's the opportunity that the Emmys, and to a lesser degree the Oscars, provided some of our most subversive comedians to showcase their particular brand of pointed, hilarious honesty about the entertainment industry. Conan O'Brien inserting himself into the biggest shows of 2006, including Lost, House, The Office, and To Catch a Predator. Jimmy Kimmel publicly scolding The Apprentice creator Mark Burnett for launching the Donald Trump phenomenon. If Donald Trump gets elected and he builds that wall, the first person we're throwing over it is Mark Burnett. Stephen Colbert praising diverse nominee Bill Maher in 2017. I assume he's black because he's so comfortable using the N-word. But there's no reason why the funny men and women of late night can't participate in hostless ceremonies going forward, perhaps serving up a monologue here or an in-the-audience stunt there. Plus, at least one top-shelf award show will almost certainly continue to have a host. CBS has the rights to the Tony Awards through 2026, and they'll have to pry that gig out of James Corden's cold, dead hands. Next up, October issue of Entertainment Weekly magazine, it's a Brad world. With award-baiting turns in Ad Astra and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Brad Pitt, age 55, has never been hotter, and his behind-the-scenes work is just as influential. The actor-producer talks with Entertainment Weekly about deep space, stardom, and the next frontier. Hint, it may be television. This article written by Leah Greenblatt. Brad Pitt has a great laugh. A sort of staccato, slow-rolling ha-ha-ha-ha-ha that makes you think of surfers and cowboys and movie stars. He uses it more than once to excellent effect as Cliff Booth, the laconic stuntman-cum-sidekick who stumbles into the dark heart of the Manson family in Quentin Tarantino's showbiz Babylon Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and not at all in the lonely astronaut epic Ad Astra, which is out now. Though it often punctuates his conversation with Entertainment Weekly about both those roles. To say that one of the world's most beloved and best-known celebrities is having a moment 30-plus years into his career feels, at this point, pretty much indisputable. But don't call it a comeback or a Bradissance. Several times over the course of a friendly, sometimes philosophical interview, he'll insist that his only goal is putting stories out into the world. Which in 2019 means not just starring in a pair of films that may well end up dominating the coming award season, but also continuing to head up Plan B Entertainment, the boutique production company responsible for a vanguard slate of films including Vice, Moonlight, Beautiful Boy, and 12 Years a Slave. That laugh comes tumbling out again when he's asked to find the thread between Hollywood's Cliff, a sort of Beach Boy Lebowski with a gift for sudden violence, and Ad Astra's Major Roy McBride, an almost pathologically contained spaceman on a solo mission to Mars. Well, Cliff is by far a much easier way to live, and certainly I would say what we're all striving for, he says, chuckling. But to get to Cliff's peace of mind and acceptance in the day, you probably have to go through Roy's dilemma to get there. Pitt quickly grows more serious, though, on the subject of Roy's arc in Astra. an emotional journey that often finds the Major struggling to maintain his NASA-trained composure, even as the fate of both his family and the free world, and the movie heavily implies his soul too, hangs in the balance. Toxic masculinity, that may be a little harsh as a term, but certainly we're questioning what is masculinity, he muses. Having grown up in an era where we are taught to be stoic, taught to be capable, not to show weakness, never be disrespected, that works for the pioneer spirit, I guess, on the plane when you're trying to make your claim, but it's also very limiting because it doesn't embrace the whole human being. And while he confesses he has no special affinity for space movies, I mean, when I was a kid, my dad took me to see Alien, and that's still everything. Astra did get him pondering the mysteries of the universe, as it were. There are powers there that we cannot even begin to understand that can bend time, he marvels, and gravitational forces that could crush a planet, and just that we ourselves are made from dying stars. I find that really awe-inspiring, specifically because of how much we don't know, and yet how connected we are to it. Astra director James Gray, who's also known for his work on The Lost City of Z, who has known Pitt for more than two decades, tells Entertainment Weekly that though he didn't pen the script for his longtime friend, I never actually write projects with actors in mind because you're always disappointed when they don't do it. He did end up getting exactly the performance he hoped for, though. In some ways, because he's a star, Brad's acting is underrated. But he understood it completely, this character who lives so much in his own head. Heady isolation isn't so much an option in Pitt's other day job as the co-founder and CEO of Plan B, which often involves developing and championing the kinds of films that fall far outside his own lived experience. It's certainly not by design, he says, of the studio's particular track record with black auteurs like Ava DuVernay and Steve McQueen. Myself and my partners, Jeremy Kleiner and Dee Dee Gardner, have an extreme belief in equality and this want for justice in an unjust world. And I think we naturally are kind of guided that way. We were trying to get Selma made for years, and it wasn't until 12 Years did what it did that it suddenly opened the door for all of these others. But you know, for every one that gets made, there's another 10, so it takes a fight for all of them. Since its 2001 founding, the company has racked up three Best Picture wins for The Departed, 12 Years a Slave, and Moonlight. But the thrice-nominated actor promises he's not interested in gunning for personal gold, despite the growing buzz on Astra and Hollywood. Oh man, I'm going to abstain, he says, of campaigning for either role. I mean, you never know, and it's really nice when your number comes up, but I find chasing it actually a disservice to the purity of your telling a story, of the story itself, and a shackling thing to focus on. He may be persuaded to move in another direction, though. The world of prestige television, where A-list peers like Nicole Kidman and Matthew McConaughey have already blazed the trail. Could I see it? Absolutely, he says. What I love about TV is you get to spend more time with the characters. You have to let go of so many scenes in order to fit into the film container as far as running time and how it plays. And with a series, being able to break it up, you can expand so much more. I'm especially drawn to the comedies that are able to do that. We'll see. We'll see where it all lands, but that's certainly of interest. In the meantime, there's more than enough to keep him busy. Between promoting his current projects and tending to a production slate that this year already includes Astra and the Sundance sensation The Last Black Man in San Francisco, which this past June, Entertainment Weekly named the best film of 2019 so far, as well as the upcoming drama The King and Moonlight director Barry Jenkins' Underground Railroad series for Amazon. So does that mean there could be some truth to a recent viral magazine quote that implied he'll soon be done with big screen acting? I was just saying it's really a younger man's game, he insists. Not that there aren't still parts and interesting things to do. Or maybe it's just me. Maybe I've just seen my interests broadening or shifting into other things. But no. One last long, no. It's not a claim of retirement. Next up, we take a look at music, and Liz Phair has horror stories. Liz Phair still has a lot to say, but now she's doing it in book form. The fierce alt-rocker gives Entertainment Weekly the inside story on the making of her revealing memoir, this article written by Alana Kaplan. Since her 1993 breakout album Exile in Guyville, Liz Phair, age 52, has garnered a reputation as a feminist pioneer in the music industry, blending her own canter and authenticity into her songwriting. That much hasn't changed, though the medium in which she expresses herself for the moment has. With the release of her memoir, Horror Stories, which was just released earlier this month, Fair unveils her most personal anecdotes, mistakes, and flaws, and connects them to universal experiences of pain, regret, and guilt. "This is how I go through life, and I want to be honest about it," she says. Fair's essays, which range from experiencing sexual harassment to getting lost in a blizzard, tout a through line of her signature wit and confront the complexities of the world around us. The rocker's desire to craft something vulnerable stemmed partly from the 2016 presidential election. For 2 years, she dedicated herself to opening up in her writing, this time in prose form. "There was such a rush within me to want to connect in a meaningful way because everything around me was so awful and disconnected," she says. Then there was the passing of both David Bowie and Prince, along with a conversation with her manager about the uncertainty of death. "It got me thinking, what would I do if it were my last piece of art? I wanted to do something meaningful and make a stand in support of not being shallow, not hiding and concealing," she recalls. Horror Stories, in many ways, is just that. As Fair calls it, her warrior stands, but instead of putting on armor, she's taking it off. Using stories from her childhood and through her career, Fair explores various horrors that she's encountered, which aren't always typical. Falling for a bandmate who had a girlfriend, being a bystander to a girl passed out in a bathroom. We're bombarded with horror all the time, but what we don't do is pull back and look at our own emotional engagement. "I feel like the world will be better if we were emotionally literate, and that's the hill I want to make my last stand on." Fair is also looking for people to slow down, adding, "We skip from big moment to big moment, and that's the story we tell ourselves about our lives. But most of what we do is small, private, and individually witnessed and experienced." While all of the chapters tell intimate details of Fair's life, there is a section in particular she's well aware people will be talking about, one that details her experiences with harassment while also shedding light on her relationship with Ryan Adams, whose alleged sexual misconduct and emotional abuse were detailed in the New York Times. "I pretty much believed it," she says of the story. "I didn't think there weren't two sides to things. I never think that. I always think there's a complexity." Following the report, Fair, who had been recording a double album with Adams, responded to a tweet asking if she'd weigh in on the situation. "If I do, I'll write about it, but I think you can extrapolate. My experience was nowhere near as personally involving, but yes, the record ended and the similarities are upsetting," she tweeted. Fair stood by her words. In Horror Stories, she gives her perspective on Adams, revealing that he had tried to better. "At the time, he didn't seem that bad to me. I didn't feel that I was abused the way the other women felt. I was also just used to a guy hitting on you in the music business like it's nothing," she admits. "What I'm trying to say is this is how bad it is, because he wasn't that bad from my perception. It was this interesting intersection of this hashtag Me Too moment and an experience I was involved in that qualified, and yet I hadn't even registered it as particularly difficult. I've had worse." Fair has not talked to Adams since the Times piece, but does in some ways seem protective of him, stating that he tried to help her. "What happened with the other women was much more devastating," she says. "That's why I didn't want to write the story, because it didn't feel like my story, but it prompted my story." But Fair doesn't want the focus of her memoir to be on Adams. It wouldn't be the first time the singer has experienced her work being lost in salaciousness. After Exile, she was given the nickname of BL Job Queen, based on a line in the song Flower that was representative of the sex-positive nature of her music. Instead of the music, that quote became the narrative around her critically acclaimed debut. The BL Job Queen thing, it's not just about one line. It took a long time before Exile and Guyville was dubbed a really solid album from start to finish, she says. Fair acknowledges that we still live in a soundbite culture, which is why she wrote Horror Stories. That's how our society works, but it shouldn't. Liz Fair says, "I want people to come away from the book being able to tell the people in their lives more about themselves." We have time for the playback. It's a rundown of notable box sets, compilations, and reissues. This article written by Sarah Rodman, spotlighting this month Janet Jackson's Rhythm Nation 1814. In 1986, Janet Jackson took control. In 1989, she formed her own country. And if we had all decided to live there in her shared vision, mission statement, "It's time to give a dang, let's work together," maybe the state of the world today would be a little better. As part of a series of reissues, the recent Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductees' acclaimed fourth album, Rhythm Nation 1814, is revisited in a new 2-LP set that restores interstitial bits and unedited versions to the Jimmy Jam Terry Lewis-produced classic. 30 years later, several elements remain striking. First, that Jackson was able to take an album largely concerned with dire social issues, poverty, racism, homelessness, to the top of the charts is remarkable, particularly in the current Shut Up and Sing era in which those issues perniciously persist. Second, Rhythm Nation is one of those albums that, in retrospect, plays like a greatest hits record. Such was its success, launching 7 top 5 hits. And the spectrum of sounds is still a thrill, with a song for every mood on an album that still hangs together. From the giddily romantic rubber band bounce of Love Will Never Do Without You, to the lacquered power chords of Black Cat, to the urgent lamentations of Living in a World They Didn't Make, and the ultimate slice of dance floor ecstasy in Miss You Much, this is still a nation worth pledging allegiance to. And finally, last week it was number one at the box office, raking in $93.5 million in its debut, the movie The Joker. And with Todd Phillips' darkly dramatic Joker in theaters now, here's our ranking of every major portrayal of the Gotham baddie, ranked by James Hibbert. There was Cesar Romero in the Batman TV series from 1966. The first live-action Joker became the template for the character, despite Romero's refusal to shave his mustache. He fully inhabits the role, but was limited by the creative constraints of the campy 1960s series. Mark Hamill in Batman the Animated Series from 1992. Stunt casting gone right. The Star Wars actor finally got to play the bad guy and excels. He's armed with limitless variations on the Joker's maniacal laugh. In the voiceover world, Hamill is the Joker. There was Jack Nicholson in Batman out in 1989. Tim Burton's Batman pioneered the superhero genre, but it was a maniac prancing Nicholson who stole the show. The actor ratchets up his trademark on-screen insanity and takes the villain to a whole new level. There's Heath Ledger in The Dark Knight. Hard to believe that was out 11 years ago. A mesmerizing gonzo anarchist whose every declaration is an earnestly told lie, Ledger gives a terrifying Oscar-winning performance, ever infused with the knowledge that the late actor will never reprise the role. And then there's Joaquin Phoenix, of course, in The Joker, in theaters now. He's the polar opposite of Jack Nicholson's gleeful take. Phoenix portrays a creepy and depressed Joker in a capital D drama, an abused and emaciated animal lashing out at societal inequity. That's the latest Hollywood news. I'm Ron Schumacher. Thank you so much for listening to Radio Reading Services. Look forward to being with you next week. Have a great day.